We're in Bloomsbury, London for episode 12 of season 2 of Travels Through Time. Hello, I'm Peter Moore, welcome to Travels Through Time. In today's episode, we're venturing back to the year 1917 to talk about literature, war, politics and life, and most of all, to do a little bit of square haunting. Mecklenburg Square stands on the outer fringes of London's Bloomsbury. It was built as a genteel environment for upwardly mobile families in the latter years of the Georgian age. But by the early 20th century, it had developed a very different character. It was outwardly a dreary place, dotted here and there with boarding houses for the sorrier sort or the peripheral figure. But as Francesca Wade shows in her sparkling debut biography, Square Haunting, Mecklenburg Square was more than what it appeared. It is at the centre of her group biography of five great women. That's Hilda Doolittle, Dorothy L. Sayers, Jane Ellen Harrison, Eileen Power and Virginia Woolf, whose lives brought them at various times to this square. The literary critic Francis Wilson has described Square Haunting as elegant, erudite and absorbing, a startlingly original debut. I met with Francesca at her publisher's Faber for a discussion about Bloomsbury and about the year 1917 just the other day. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Hello Francesca, it's a pleasure to be talking to you today.
You too.
Let me begin with a little description of Bloomsbury that you quote about halfway through the book. You say, oh, this is from the English novelist Marjorie Allingham, and she wrote that Bloomsbury is a sort of halfway house. If you lived here, you were either going up or coming down. Is that a good description of Bloomsbury in the year 1917?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Bloomsbury has a really interesting architectural history because, as you said, when it was originally developed, it was intended to be a kind of upper middle class suburb for wealthy families, and the houses were actually built to accommodate a nuclear family with, you know, a mews at the back for the patriarch to keep his horses so he could go out to work, in the drawing room where the women of the house would sit. But actually, by the time any of these squares and houses were developed, any family who was rich enough to buy one wanted to live in West London, so these houses ended up eventually, to the annoyance of the landlord, having to be divided up into flats. So they became places where individuals or single people could live on their own. And this, towards the end of the 19th century, was a time when life was changing very fast for women. A lot of women were graduating from university for the first time, were perhaps looking to live in different ways and wanted living arrangements which would enable that. So this sudden proliferation of kind of single rooms and boarding houses in this particular area of London gave a real opportunity to the five women, particularly in this book.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, that change from the big, I suppose, genteel house to the compartmentalised way of living. And, well, let's just do, I think it's really important as we start off to do a bit of geographical location, because we are recording this at Faber, which is right in the heart of Bloomsbury. And on my way here, I walked to Mecklenburg Square. I think it probably took 15 minutes or so to get from there to here. Mm. It's out on the fringes, isn't it? In the northeast of Bloomsbury, if you want to kind of define this newly defined area, geographically, of course. It's not too far away, is it?
It's not far, no, but it is somehow quite a hidden corner. People tend not to particularly know about it. At the time it was laid out, Clerkenwell Beyond was a really poor area, and the early residents of Mecklenburg Square complained about prostitutes and beggars from Gray's Inn Road behind, to the extent that the landlords, the founding estate, erected a kind of barrier at the end to keep it out. So it's always been a kind of place of transition. It was intended to be upper class, but there were always this kind of threat that it, you know.
You're right, you've gone, haven't you? You've left the city somehow. So it's that half and half. And I suppose this idea of a transient liminal zone, people are very interested in these ideas in literature anyway at the moment.
Yeah.
But you've managed to locate one right in the middle of London.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of the writers, I did a lot of reading of particularly novels by women who lived in Bloomsbury or who set their books in Bloomsbury, and people always remark on both on the centrality of it and how exciting it feels to live right in the centre of things. Virginia Woolf describes sitting in her living room and, you know, watching the people passing by and just sort of finding so many new characters for her novels just by looking out of the window. But people also talk about how quiet it is and how kind of peaceful. I think in Jean Rhys's books there's some nice descriptions of kind of just walking around Bloomsbury just to kind of, you know, get out of the boarding house, which often inside was very chaotic if you were living in crowded, cramped, sort of cheap lodgings.
Yeah, absolutely. So before we depart from a bit of geography, it's a big square, isn't it? It's big. When I was walking around it, it struck me as capacious. I don't know what the word is. Is it different today in appearance to how it was in the year 1917, which is the year we're going to be talking about?
It's pretty different because Mecklenburg Square was bombed pretty badly in October 1940, which meant that large parts of the north and east sides were destroyed. So there's a little section on the end of the north side where you can see today a blue plaque to HD, and that house is still intact as it was, but the rest of that street is now belongs to Goodenough College, which provides accommodation for international students. So most of the square on that side is no longer as it was, which means you have to do some imagining.
You do have to do some imagining. Well, let's...
But the east side, which was the kind of gem of the Georgian architecture, is very much as it was. The most part, there were these sort of stucco pillars which were modelled on John Nash's Regent's Park, which you can still see today.
So if you want to glimpse it, that's the direction to look in, to the east. So if that's the geography, we've thought about the square a little bit. What about the year 1917? It's a year which I suppose a lot of our listeners will come to with an idea about what was going on, perhaps at the Western Front of France. It's the Russian Revolution, of course. There's this moment when you start your narrative properly on about page 35 or something. There's a wonderful quote from D.H. Lawrence, who's setting up this age, and he says that it was in 1915 that the old world ended. In the winter of 1915-16, the spirit of the old London collapsed. The city in some way perished from being a heart at the centre of the world to become a vortex of broken passions, lusts, hopes, fears, horrors. Is that the perfect setup for our year 1917, do you think? Does it catch something of the reality in London?
Yeah, I think so, definitely. Yeah, Lawrence, I mean, hated the war and everything it stood for, and I think that's from his book Kangaroo, which in fact describes a moment that we might come to talk about, which is his own arrival in Mecklenburg Square.
How badly was London suffering in 1917?
Because I think there was a real sense of fear and of transition. And in fact, that idea of transition is probably what made me interested in the interwar period, and particularly kind of 1917 as a time, particularly for women, I guess, when things were changing very fast and where they were on the cusp of imminent destruction of a lot of things and a lot of ways of life and possibly physical surroundings, but also in a potential sense of promise for a different future. And I'm quite interested in, I guess, most of the women in this book were born towards the end of the 19th century, which had been a time of real change for women, particularly in education. The campaign for the vote was developing fast, and so the women born in that generation were growing up or were sort of, you know, coming to be adults at a time when it seemed like they were going to have futures very different from what their mothers perhaps could have imagined. So they were making these decisions like whether to get married, have children, how to arrange their homes, what sort of work to do against the background of this kind of immense political chaos and turmoil.
Could you tell us what you picked for your first scene, please?
Well, for my first scene, I'm hoping to gain entry to number 44 Mecklenburg Square one evening in November 1917. I'll head up to the first floor and I'll take up residence probably on the chaise longue, which H.G. describes in her novel Bid Me to Live, the way that the room was decorated, which sounds very haphazard. There are sort of eggs under the stairs and coffee cups everywhere. And there's a Spanish screen which separated this large room into a few different areas. So I'd set up there, look out onto the balcony. So HD, maybe I should explain a bit more who
she is. You've taken us into her house, so you should probably explain
why we've got there.
Who this enigmatic HD is, because she surely had a name which was beyond the initials. So
she did.
Can you tell us a little bit about her and why you'd want to be on her show's launch more importantly?
Well, Hilda Doolittle was an American poet. She came to London in 1911 from Philadelphia. As a teenager, she was briefly engaged to Ezra Pound, who remained a close friend, and when she arrived in London, where he had moved a few years earlier, he very much took her under his wing and championed her poetry. He introduced her to writers like Yeats and Ford Madox Ford, and he sent some of her early verses to an influential American magazine under the name H.D. Imagist, because he was kind of propounding this movement he called Imagism, which focused on directness and clarity, and he thought that her poetry exemplified these values that he wanted to champion, which H.D. was, she was very pleased to have her poetry published, but she was never too sure about the initials H.D., and when she saw them in print, sort of ever after, she always felt slightly as if she had been taken under the shadow of Pound in a way that didn't truly reflect her identity.
We had one of our episodes about a Regency early, well, late Victorian poet called L.E.L., Letitia Landon. Did it, in fact, I know you have a bit about her just being described as an American woman living in London who's unknown to us. Was that the kind of the author bio on her first
That was her first author bio, her identity.
And we always
love
a slight literary intrigue, don't we? So did she have an air of mystique generally?
I think she did a little bit. When she arrived in London, people often described her as quite ethereal. I think she wore quite sort of flowing Greek gowns, and people were quite impressed by her. She was quite eccentric. I think she had left school, she dropped out of university, and her friend William Carlos Williams remembered that she threw ink all over herself in order to give herself a sense of freedom. She had quite strict parents and very much wanted to escape from them and kind of create her own way of living. And I think that it was difficult for her, particularly after she got married. She and Aldington thought a lot about the sort of relationship that they wanted to be in, and through her life she lived in quite different relationships. She lived with Briar for 40 years in varying kinds of menage after she left Mecklenburg Square. So really her whole life was an experiment and a kind of narrative which she wrote over and over again. She always rewrote the novels that she wrote about herself. She was creating herself anew over and over. She had a long period of analysis with Freud as well, which in fact he urged her to reconsider these years in Mecklenburg Square, because he felt that they held a key to a part of her identity that she had sort of suppressed.
So enigmatic, I think, is fair as a description. And to encounter her in 1917 in Mecklenburg Square, what does it be to encounter someone who's in a moment of personal crisis? You've talked briefly about her husband and him being away at the front. Do you want to say a little bit more about their personal relationship?
Yeah, I think this was very much a moment of crisis and of transition for HD. They'd been married, I guess, for 4 years by this point. HD had a stillbirth in 1915, which she always associated very strongly with the war, and with this sense of death being all around, hearing the raids outside, and this sort of tragedy kind of within her own body affected her very strongly. Her husband was called up in 1916, and then she experienced this strange thing of only seeing him, you know, when he could come home on leave. He also at this point was having an affair with a woman who lived upstairs in Mecklenburg Square called Arabella York. And so increasingly when he came home on leave, he wasn't just coming to see HD, he was going upstairs. And HD reacted quite strangely to this, in that I think she sort of let it happen. She eventually invited them to use the big room that she was in, and she went and slept upstairs. But she writes a lot later about feeling very split and feeling like she sort of is no longer in her own body. She's both the woman with her husband and this woman sort of watching from outside. And at this time in her own work, she was writing a lot of translations from Greek tragic choruses, mostly focusing on women who are kind of powerless, but who are watching the war unfold before them.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about her work, because it's really interesting to me. You mentioned imagism. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Mm. I'll get it right. Which she's seen as a central part of that movement. And her, is it her first collections of poems was The Sea Garden, is that right?
Sea Garden, yeah.
Which you call poems of timeless impersonal beauty.
Mm.
Is that a fair way? Well, could you go into that a little bit more as a bit of literary history? What was going on with that movement that was different?
Mm.
And how much excitement did it have around that time? Or was it just a manufactured
Well, I think there are varying ideas around it. Aldington called it advertising bulldust, I think. And Pound moved on from imagism pretty quickly after he was kind of deposed from being its leader by a woman called Amy Lowell, who came to London and really wanted to champion imagist poetry herself and was quite rich. And so she offered to fund a regular imagist anthology, and which the contents would be selected pretty democratically from this circle of poets who held similar poetic values. And Pound didn't really like that at all, so he turned his attentions to a new movement.
Does it have any lasting currency in the year 2020 imagism? Or do you think it's one of these things that burn brightly and burnt out quite quickly?
I mean, HD's early poetry is incredibly beautiful and very powerful. I definitely would recommend reading it. They're often set at the sort of borderlines between kind of earth and sea, often focusing on very small, very intense kind of moments of natural beauty, like wetness on a pebble or the sea moving.
I think I'm guessing the reason why you picked this scene as a particularly interesting one is that you have one intriguing literary figure who's at the heart of your book, but then enter stage right, one of the greats of early 20th century literature, who moves into, is it the same room? Has he come to stay? What's happening?
Well,
pick up the story.
This is D.H. Lawrence. So yeah, into the mix in October 1917. D.H. Lawrence was exiled from his home in Cornwall after police officers burst in to find him and his wife Frida singing German folk songs around the piano, which was very suspicious.
Nothing suspicious about that at all.
And they were told that they had to leave their cottage in 3 days. And HD immediately invited them to come to stay with her at Mecklenburg Square. And we don't really know much about what happened in the 2 months or so that the Lawrence spent with HD, because all we really have to go on is two pretty contradictory accounts in the novels that each of them wrote about the period. HD left the square in 1918. She went, in fact, to Cornwall to live with a friend of Lawrence's called Cecil Gray. She became pregnant, had her daughter Perdita, who she brought up with this woman Briar after Gray left her very abruptly. And she spent pretty much the rest of her life on and off analysing this period and this very complex cycle of novels, all exploring a protagonist who experiences writer's block, trauma of war, difficult relationships. And when she had her analysis with Freud, he encouraged her to go back to this novel and write it again. And when she did, the version that was finally published, none of the earlier versions were published, but the one that was published featured a character that none of the other manuscripts had included, who was very clearly based on D.H. Lawrence. And when it came out, people were very confused about it, because it seemed like there was, I mean, it's not entirely explicit what goes on between them at all, but the main character, Julia, who's very clearly HD, clearly has a very serious sort of passion for this Frederico, and there's a real power struggle between them, and readers were confused. They didn't know that HD and Lawrence had sort of had an affair. People started saying, well, she must be Lady Chatterley, he must be the father of her child, this is a confession.
I love the fact that Frederico is a name, such a swashbuckling name. And we don't know, of course, what happened, but that's, I suppose, one of the tantalising dimensions of history, that you have these ingredients and you can't really see what the result is. Do you think they would have got on?
HD and Lawrence. Well, I think they had clearly a intriguing and complicated and quite brief relationship. They'd met in about 1915 and they had exchanged manuscripts of their works in progress. So Lawrence, when he was writing Women in Love, he sent it to her to critique, and she sent him some of her poems. She was moving away into this style based more on mythological figures like Cassandra and Leda and Helen. But I think when she's writing about Lawrence, I don't think it's to confess that they had an affair. I think really what she was doing was setting to rest this kind of crisis of confidence that he had inspired in her in the course of the conversations that it seems that they probably had in Mecklenburg Square. And there's a significant part of the book where Julia, the HD character, shows Federico a poem that she's working on about Orpheus and Eurydice, and he reacts very strongly and tells her that she shouldn't try to write from the man's voice, she should just focus on the female experience. And Julia is very hurt by this and shocked. And the end of the book, in fact, is a letter that Julia writes to Federico where she explains to him why telling her that she should only write as a woman, you know, was constraining her, wasn't allowing her to reach her full potential as a writer. And in fact, you know, to be free, she had to be allowed to say something universal and not be confined into, you know, a purely female experience. And I think that was really the kind of struggle that HD grappled with throughout her life. As we were talking about with her name, she'd always felt under the shadow of men. She'd always had people tell her who she was and who she could be. And so I think in this final letter that she wrote in the very last year of her life, the book was published in 1960, through writing facts of D.H. Lawrence, this was her real assertion of herself as a writer.
But I think that's the thinking about it. This seems to be the absolute central dimension of this scene, is this exchange between HD and DH.
Mm-hmm. She says something like, I feel he has the power in him to engulf me, which I think is a kind of acknowledgement at that time that he posed a real threat, I think, to her sense of herself as a writer, if it is the case that he was trying to shape what she was writing, and just at a time when she was trying to kind of expand
her provinces. This is all really tantalizing stuff, isn't it? Because you've given us so much to ponder here about this coming together of two great creative forces, if you like. We're actually going to leave Mecklenburg Square. We've spoken so much about it, but we're going to leave it for our second scene, which is where?
Well, the second scene, I'm going to linger outside the door of Hogarth House in Richmond on the 24th of April, and I'm going to watch Leonard and Virginia Woolf unpack their first printing press.
Right, okay. Again, I feel like we should do a little bit of geography just for any American listeners who aren't particularly sure about where Richmond is. It's, apparently, the Georgians used to call it the nicest village in England, situated on the Thames. It's, I don't know, a few miles upstream from West London anyway. So quite idyllic, really. You're in a nice place to be. It's April 1917. Virginia Woolf and Leonard Woolf probably don't need so much introduction.
Well, this was a pretty difficult time in Woolf's life. She'd experienced a really dark period of mental illness, which had kind of confined her to bed and eventually forced her to leave Bloomsbury, where she'd been living since 1904. And Bloomsbury had been a really significant place for Woolf. She'd grown up in a very kind of dark, austere family home in Kensington, where, you know, she wasn't allowed to do too much. And after her parents died, she and her siblings moved to Bloomsbury, and they decided that everything was going to be different. They were going to, you know, paint the house in bright colours. They were going to have friends over. They weren't going to have set meal times. The women could have studies. And that was where Virginia started to write and, yeah, really came to develop the ideas that she would set down in a room of one's own about the conditions that women need in order to be creative and to fulfil their potential.
And she goes a bit beyond a room of one's own here, because she's actually putting a printing press in as well. £38 on type.
Yeah.
This all takes us back to older kind of industrial and technological history. This is quite idea.
Yeah.
The idea of the printing machine coming.
Yeah. Well, so she had, it was Leonard's idea for them to move out to Richmond for the kind of comparative piece, because you know, with the idea that Virginia needed some kind of convalescence. And they found that sort of repetitive tasks like gardening or kind of manual labour really helped her. And so what they decided, this was the reason they decided to buy a printing press in the first place, that they thought that kind of arranging the type.
So almost as a form of therapy.
Yeah, exactly. And it was, and the type in those days was really sort of heavy, and you know, you had to put the letters the right way up and you had to put them in order. So you really had to concentrate. Virginia got them upside down most of the time.
Exactly. It can be out of sorts. I learned that was old printers. Little sorts would be each piece of type.
You can actually see the Wolfe's printing press at Vita Sackville West's old house at Sissinghurst in Kent. They have the original one there, so you can see how heavy it is. And when they brought it home from the shop, they put it on the kitchen table and immediately it broke. So they had to go back to the shop to wait a couple of weeks for it to be repaired.
So would it be...
If I'd been there, maybe I would have...
Would you watch it coming in through the door? Because it's a hugely symbolic moment. Of course, printing presses is... I mean, we can interpret it in several ways, can't we, really? It could be as a form of therapy for someone. And you note that she had nervous breakdowns in 1895, 1904, 1913, 1915. So this is, Virginia Woolf's got a serious long-term, you know, condition with her mental health. So it can be viewed through that lens. But also, a printing press is power. Mm. It's the ability to print whatever you like. And at a time, you know, when you had things like conscription, which is a great, you know, impingement on liberty, the sense of freedom that printing press must have brought, and with the propaganda the censorship which is happening in the newspapers. I mean, they couldn't even report properly what was happening in France. So to have your own printing press must have been quite a thing.
Yeah. And I think she felt it was extremely liberating for her own writing, because quite quickly they decided that they would publish her own novels, which meant that she no longer had to worry about sending them to an outside editor. And she wrote to a friend that she was the only woman in England free to write what I like. She says, "We get so absorbed we can't stop. I see that real printing will devour one's entire life." And immediately, this is the bit I'd really like to see. I think she and Leonard were instantly kind of brimming with ideas of what they wanted to do with this press, which involved publishing their own books, as you said, but also printing books by their friends. One of the first things she did was go to see Catherine Mansfield to ask her for a story, which became one of the first books or pamphlets that the press published. And she told a friend, our brains hum with all sorts of works. You can't think how exciting, soothing, ennobling and satisfying it is. It was a form of income for them. I mean, by 1923, they were publishing over a dozen titles each year, and Leonard kept very careful notes of all of their profits, and they had quite a sweet system where they each took an allowance at the end of the year, which they could spend completely on themselves. So they called it their hoard or something. So financially, I mean, it accompanied their own writing and the other work that they were doing. I mean, they did have their own private money as well, but the money from the Hogarth Press was significant to them, increasingly so.
I think we should connect this story to Mecklenburg Square as well before we leave, because, yeah, to be there in Richmond, to see the press as a symbol of possibility and hope and recovery, really interesting. And Virginia Woolf at the heart of the scene, and with Leonard there. I think we'll talk more about him in a moment as well. But they, of course, are connected so strongly with Bloomsbury and the idea of Bloomsbury. But they do come to Mecklenburg Square themselves, don't they?
Yeah, after they left Richmond, I think in 1924, they moved to Tavistock Square, where they lived until 1939, when the building works on the hotel opposite were so loud that they just couldn't get anything done. So they looked for somewhere quieter to go, and that's when they came to 37 Mecklenburg Square. And they moved in the week that the Second World War was declared, so it was another moment of arrival at a time of, well, both the possibility and excitement of a new home, but amid this absolute horror that Virginia Woolf writes in her diary about walking around the house and thinking, which of these rooms am I going to die in? That was the sort
and they're
of sensation.
Blitz, aren't they, really?
Yeah, so they lived partly in Monk's House out in Sussex. So they had this routine where they went between sort of town and country.
So how did they divide up the work on the Hogarth Press, and how did they get on, Leonard and Virginia, during this time?
Well, the Wolfe relationship is a really interesting one, and part of the reason I'd like to go back to this moment would be to see the kind of dynamic in their relationship as they start to work together. Some people say that Leonard was very controlling of Virginia. Others say that he, you know, saved her life and by, you know, making her kind of move out to Richmond and not do too much in these sort of times of stress. She told him before she married him that she refused to look on marriage as a profession and wanted their relationship to be, as she called it, a tremendous living thing. She wrote a very frank letter basically saying, I'm not really attracted to you, but I'm willing to give this a go on the basis that the only kind of relationship I could imagine being in is one of equals. And I think the fact of the way they work together on the Hogarth Press really exemplifies that part of their relationship, collaborating on something creative, productive within their home, and, you know, turning their home into a workplace where they were equal partners. I mean, Leonard did certainly do more of the work, but Virginia was always around. She always collaborated on manuscripts. She'd come in and help tie up the parcels to send them out to reviewers. She'd be part of the conversations around who they wanted to publish and around the kind of international publishing that they wanted to do, although that was probably driven by Leonard's
work. You just presented to me a nightmarish vision of me working with my wife in a small room with one painting.
I'm sure there are many arguments.
Yeah. They say you shouldn't work with family members, but it was successful after a fashion, wasn't it?
Mm.
And that tells you a lot about their relationship. How long had they been married by this point?
It was pretty early on in their marriage. Yeah, they'd been married a few years, but this continued on. I mean, Virginia sort of retired from the Hogarth Press in sort of the mid-30s, but was still on hand.
Have you got any Hogarth Press books at home in your collection?
Not original, not from the time. Well, I've seen a few nice ones with the 37 Mecklenburg Square address in them, because they didn't print that many from that address. They were only there for a year. I think the first one they did was Henry Green's Party Going.
Well, let's carry on with Leonard, because we've looked at HD, we've seen a bit of DH Lawrence, we've had Virginia Woolf. What do you want to do for your third scene?
For my third scene, I'm thinking that I will spend an afternoon at the 1917 Club in Soho. And in fact, if it was the 19th of December, I could go to their first meeting.
What was the 1917 Club? That's the obvious question, and I'm going to ask it.
Yeah, well, it was a discussion group for socialists founded by Leonard Woolf and his friend Oliver Strachey, and it was named for the February Revolution. And it was originally the idea was for it to be a kind of political club for people to come and meet and talk about politics, but it also had, I think Leonard described it as having an element of unadulterated culture, literary and artistic. So they had premises at 4 Gerrard Street in Soho, and the clientele were a sort of mix of Labour politicians, Bloomsbury artists, people like H.G. Wells, Ramsay MacDonald, Rose Macaulay, E.M. Forster would come there. Virginia Woolf spent a lot of time there and found it quite convivial.
So it was open to all, and you just had to have the right politics, or was it more... I noticed that Oswald Mosley was a member at one point, which doesn't sound too good.
No.
100 years on.
No, it didn't sound too good. I think they were open.
But I think he was maybe not quite what he became at this point. So this is a different... Okay, well, the 1917 Club is the perfect name for a club. In a podcast about the year 1917, I imagine it has something to do with the Russian Revolution, because we have a slightly left-wing club in the heart of London. Everyone probably knows that the Russian Revolution happened in 1917. Is that the obvious connection? Am I making it
correctly? Yeah, that's the connection. I think in lots of ways in Britain, 1917 was kind of the year of Russia. I mean, for some years, there was a huge British interest in Russian culture and literature, dance, music, politics. People had been to the Ballet Russe, which took Covent Garden by storm in 1911, and that year was also the first London production of Chekhov's plays. And then in 1912, Roger Fry included a section of Russian art in his second post-impressionist exhibition.
Right, so is there a sense that maybe the Russians are leading the way culturally, and also they're about to start leading the way, or they are already leading the way politically?
Yeah, I think there was real excitement, particularly about Russian literature, because Constance Garnett in 1912 published an English translation of The Brothers Karamazov, which was the first introduction of Dostoevsky to an English readership. And so over these years, she was incredibly prolific, and she translated into English kind of most of the canon of Russian 19th century literature. And this meant that people like Virginia Woolf and Catherine Mansfield were reading the Russians, you know, as they were reading the latest bestseller. So they really felt these people were their contemporaries, and they were so excited by these kind of new psychological depths that Dostoevsky in particular.
Have you managed to trace this interest right into the published works from these writers at this time? Does anything of Russia bubble up the other end?
Well, Wolf, I mean, we're talking about the Hogarth Press, and Wolf was especially excited to publish Russian translations, and she even tried to learn Russian herself. There's an interesting guy called Samuel Kosolyansky who did a lot of translation from Russian for Hogarth, and he was good friends with Lawrence as well, and Catherine Mansfield and Wolf, and they all at times kind of collaborated on these translations which Hogarth was publishing. And I'm particularly interested in Russia because of another figure in my book, Jane Harrison, who was a classicist, but who later in life became very fascinated by Russia, in particular the language. And she published a translation of an autobiography of the archpriest Avakum, which the Hogarth Press published and were very excited to add to their Russian list.
So to be there in the club, listening to the conversations about politics, which are inevitably going to be led by what's happening in Russia,
yeah.
This idea of a new utopia, which in a way takes you across the centuries, maybe back into the ancient world of like imagined societies in a strange way. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think lots of people in the sort of socialist circles were hugely delighted by the February Revolution, where the Tsar Nicholas and his establishment was overthrown by this kind of mass uprising of workers and soldiers demanding, you know, freedom and justice and equality. And I think at a time when people were in some despair about the state of British politics, they saw in it a kind of romance, which Leonard Woolf likened it to the French Revolution, as this sort of promise of reform and alternatives to the old systems. D.H. Lawrence wrote that, "I feel our chiefest hope for the future is Russia." And he at that time was writing a lot to HD, in fact, about the idea of kind of leaving, going off to the Andes and starting a whole new kind of society, which would be, you know, egalitarian and sort of communal.
Do you know that thing when the revolution started in France and Wordsworth said to be alive was very heaven, that famous quote? Maybe there's a bit of that about this moment.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it was, I guess, ironically, it was quite easy for these sort of British socialists to sit around in Soho talking about how exciting the revolution was, whereas in Russia it was certainly not as clear-cut as that. And I mean, the October Revolution, when the Bolshevik Party ousted the provisional government and seized control, the kind of excitement of the revolution turned into quite a chaotic civil war between the Bolsheviks and the White Army, which forced millions to flee the country and created these kind of diasporas across Europe, where people often were living and working in real poverty. And this is where Jane Harrison's perspective is an interesting and slightly different one, perhaps because she really got to know some emigre Russians. There's a writer called Alexei Remizov and another one called D.S. Mirsky, who she spent a lot of time with and wanted to support their projects. They were, Mirsky in particular, was working on a magazine to give a platform to Russians who were living in exile and weren't able to be published in Russia due to censorship. And she encouraged him to ask the Wolfs, in particular Leonard Woolf, to help him with funding and with editorial guidance. So that was a moment of kind of real cultural collaboration.
Well, this takes us back to Leonard Woolf, who's having a very busy 1917. He's starting his printing press, looking after his ill wife, and founding the 1917 Club.
Must have been very exciting.
Would you also like to see Leonard Woolf kind of out there on his own? Because sometimes he's always with Virginia when we read about him. Would it be quite interesting to be sat in that audience?
Yeah, I'd sit with him.
Yeah, it's a nice idea, isn't it?
Yeah, the 1917 Club incidentally also gets a kind of cameo mention in Dorothy Sayers. And this is another example of how Bloomsbury is much wider than just the Bloomsbury group. Dorothy Sayers, in her second crime novel, Clouds of Witness, has her detective Lord Peter Whimsey has to rescue his sister from a club on Gerrard Street, which she describes as being founded to accommodate free thinking rather than high living. And he gets punched outside, and his mother later says that he shouldn't have expected anything else if he insists on haunting low places full of socialists taking themselves seriously, given to drinking coffee and writing poems with no shape to them and generally ruining their nerves.
Well, there's
so not everyone took it so seriously.
Yeah, exactly. The word haunting is the one that pops up in that. And that's pretty much what we've been doing in homage to your own book. I think we've been haunting these scenes in a conversational kind of way from our lofty perch in 2020. But really enjoyable and interesting and enlightening at the same time. We've got a few more things. We're going to leave the scenes behind now. We're back. Here we are in 2020. But as part of our any other business, I'd like to ask if you could bring a tangible object back to 2020 from 1917. What would you like?
Well, I thought I would go back to 44 Mecklenburg Square, and I would bring back, I'd go down to the basement, and I would find a suitcase stuffed with letters, which Richard Aldington had written to HD from the front, and also that's where she collected her letters from D.H. Lawrence. And these letters, she left them behind when she left the square in 1918 and moved to Cornwall. And later, when she came back, her landlady didn't know where they were, and she later found out that Richard Aldington said that he'd burned them, kind of in fury at everything that had gone on. So we've lost a huge amount of what would have maybe told us a little bit more about the dynamic both between HD and her husband. Absolutely. And between her and Lawrence.
And from that great era of letter writing as well, when people wrote pages of descriptive prose. A little bit more about the book then before we finish. We've been through the scenes, we've talked about 1917, but these are obviously just a part of your narrative, and it's structured quite peculiarly in a way. I mean, there's the square here, and then you've got these five lives which kind of crisscross the square. And I think that's where you get these... I'm sure lots of people will tell you it's original, because it feels different and it feels enlivening, and it feels like you captured something of the spirit and the energy of that time in these narratives. How long has it been a project for you?
Mecklenburg Square. I started working on it in 2015, I think, and have been on the go since then. I've came across the square pretty much by chance. I studied HD at university, and I knew that she'd lived there, and I knew when I discovered that Virginia Woolf had lived in the same square, I got intrigued to think about all these other lives that seemed to have been going on in the same place in this, you know, period of transition between the world wars, and kind of wondered what had brought them there and whether there was anything that linked them. And that's when I started to think a lot more about A Room of One's Own and what women of this time needed if they were going to live differently and, you know, experiment and be writers, and, you know, take advantage of the kind of new possibilities that were being thrown at them, but also, you know, having to contend still with, you know, with attitudes, with the need to, you know, to make the rent, to live in their houses, and the knowledge that there was still, it was still going to be difficult to live in a different way.
It's a beautifully, beautifully written book. It's a fascinating insight into the time and into those characters. So huge congratulations.
Thank
you for taking the time to talk to us today.
You.
That was me, Peter Moore, talking to Francesca Wade about her new book, Square Haunting, which is published in hardback by Faber this week. We'll be back with More travels through time next Tuesday, so please do subscribe to our feed to get the first news of that. All I've got left to say to you today, though, is thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. Goodbye.
Hello, I'm John Hillman, one of the producers on the Travels Through Time podcast. I hope you enjoyed Peter's conversation with Francesca Wade. You can explore similar episodes like Diane Atkinson on the year 1914 or Lucasta Miller's exploration of the Georgian poet L.E.L. And you can do that over on our website, tttpodcast.com, where you'll also find many other fascinating adventures into the past, which I'm sure you'll enjoy. So thank you very much for listening, and we look forward to welcoming you back very soon.